Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Love is in the air.
It's love. It's love. Well, who would have thought it?
Hearts, roses, candy. What more could one want in the month of love?
How about more contributors to our Patreon? After all, we are a self-funded podcast.
This is true. This is true.
So if you love us,
yes,
head on over to patreon.com.
That's right.
It's pronounced love, but spelled patreon.com. And search for Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends, and set a monthly donation. Even a dollar a month helps us, I feel like Sally Struthers. Mm. Your contributions help us continue doing what we are doing.
Oh, I'm going to go home and snuggle with my wife right now, Rob.
And I'm off for a hot Valentine's Day with my favorite gal, Mama Celeste.
Help us on Patreon so Rob can upgrade to DiGiorno.
DiGiorno, get the line out.
Or Elio's. I'm sorry, I didn't realize it was on me to make the punchline, but you had me at Mama Celeste.
I have a lot of people at Mama Celeste.
A lot of pizza That's favorites. It.
Hi, I'm Rob Schneider.
And I'm Kevin David Thomas.
And this is Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Broadway Curtain and make sure to join our Facebook page at Behind the Curtain, Broadway's Living Legends.
And follow us on Instagram at Broadway Curtain Podcast Plus. You can always listen to our podcasts on Broadway World and Stitcher.
A visual style that cannot be rivaled, a legacy that will continue to influence designers centuries from now, and the ability to claim collaborations with Noel Coward, Walt Disney, Sidney Lumet, Bob Fosse and Tommy Toon are just a few statements of fact about today's wonderful guest.
His CV reads like a who's who of the past 60 years of entertainment, so we will just give you some highlights. Well, he was the costume designer and visual consultant for the original Mary Poppins, an Oscar for 1979's All That Jazz, Oscar nominations for Murder on the Orient Express and The Wiz, set designs for the original productions of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, Golden Boy, The Apple Tree, Pippin, Chicago, Grand Hotel, Six Degrees of Separation, The Will Rogers Follies, the 1992 revival of Guys and Dolls, Steel Pier, and many others, plus a relatively recent foray into the directing the works of Wells, Wilde, and Coward.
To tell us what it was like to work with such legends as the Sherman Brothers, Zero Mostel, Patricia Ziprod, Jerry Zaks, Mike Nichols, Diana Ross, and so many more, here is the Oscar, Emmy, and Tony Award-winning Renaissance man of the theater, Mr. Tony Walton.
Ooh. Hello.
Hello, Tony.
Hello. Tony,
please excuse my voice. It's going through a change of life.
That's all right. We can hear you, and we're happy about it.
We can hear you, and we're happy. So we're going to start right at the beginning. Where did you grow up?
Well, oddly and coincidentally, a place called Walton-on-Thames.
Mm. Oh, that's convenient.
Southwest of London, yeah. And my sister still lives there. There's still family connections. So we get to go back from time to time.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And I went to Radley College in Oxford. Mm-hmm. And while I was there, I displeased one of my professors in the classics remove because I'd been planning to be a doctor. Shall I just babble like this?
Yes,
exactly.
We love this.
Right, Tony. This is exactly right.
This is gold, not babbling for us.
Oh, good. My dad was a very distinguished surgeon and, in fact, continued to surge until the age of 97. He was still seeing patients up until a week before he died in 97.
May we all have that luck.
Exactly.
Yes, yeah. And I'll pass along to your listeners his final piece of advice, which 97 years, you're really waiting to hear what that's going to be. And he went like this, and I put my ear near his mouth, and he said, "Should you ever reach your 70s, his voice was much like mine is now, should you ever reach your 70s, try never to pass a toilet." And I thought... And I thought, well, that's the accumulation.
There it is. There it is.
The secret of life, listeners, from Tony Walton. Yeah.
Now I think, thanks, Dad.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. That's a
good punchline. So how did you fall in love with the theater?
Yeah.
Well, my parents, before they were together, lived equidistant from the birthplace and early home of Noel Coward. And surprisingly for Brits of that era, made no judgment as to his sexual preferences or anything else, huh. And were very proud of Local Boy Made Good. They were big enthusiasts of his work,
yeah.
And they had old 78 RPM radio, you know,
yeah.
records of his work. And so we, their three kids, were very familiar with that as we were growing up. And I read everything of his. And I don't know quite why that led me into the theater, but it did. And in, I would say, just prior to my teens, I discovered that a young lass, a very young lass, called Julie Andrews, lived in our same village of Walton-on-Thames.
The same town, yeah.
And she had been somewhat famous vaudevillian performer from about the age of five.
Really?
On, yeah.
Okay.
Originally with her mom and her stepdad, but eventually she became the draw of the three of them.
And of course.
She supported the whole family.
Wow.
Which became both a blessing and a problem, you know.
Did you always want to be a designer? Is that what attracted you?
No, I was presuming I would be, I would hope to be a director.
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, I was thinking I would be an actor to get to learn as much as possible. And not far from our home in Wimbledon, famed for its
escort, yes.
There was a wonderful old Edwardian theatre called Wimbledon Repertory Theatre, which did new productions every 2 weeks. And my elder sister's boyfriend was a leading player and sometime director there. And so she was invited into the company from time to time. And I applied to join them. I'd been acting and directing a lot in school and college, and I'd been very cocky
actor-director. As you are in college.
Yes.
The first production, I think it was called Lady Audley's Secret.
Oh. Oh, my.
I had a small part, and my sister also had a small part, and she got laryngitis. And so on the opening night, I was throwing her lines, which threw me a little bit. But I got through it. But realizing midway that it was fine performing for fellow students and chums and family and so on, but to be performing as an amateur, technically, for a paying audience was another matter altogether.
Yes, indeed.
And I became very self-conscious. Mm. And I went to the fabulous old actor manager, who a brand who still just existed in those days, and said, "Is there anything I can do to keep my 3 guineas a week salary?" It was like $10 a week.
Yeah.
And he said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "I don't think I'm really an actor." I didn't realize how self-conscious I was going to get once I knew the folks out there were actually paying to see us, you know, and were clearly familiar with professional performers and so on. He said, "Well, you know, we always need stagehands. So, and you can keep your 3 guineas." So I became a stagehand, with probably the most useful thing that ever happened to me.
Wow.
Because you experience everything.
You see it all.
And as you get to know, as you progress in your career, it's the stagehands who know better than anyone how it's all going, what's going on.
That's true. They always say if the stagehands are talking about closing, your show's probably going to be closing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. One of my very favorite theater memories is about a great old Irish stagehand in the Broadway theater who I worked with a few times, Jimmy Brennan. Huh. Fabulous, you know, 10-foot tall Irishman. And we became very friendly, and we were doing the Sammy Davis
Golden Boy,
Strauss and Adams, which was the first Broadway production used a great deal of scenic projection, which is something that my oldest mate in the theater, Richard Pilbrow, and I had been developing in London, and this had been going well, so I had managed to persuade Strauss and Adams and Peter Coe that it was a good way to approach Golden Boy, because they were wanting it to be as much about the difficulties of being black in New York at that time.
Yeah, yeah.
And it therefore cast Sammy Davis. Yeah. At any rate, enough about all that. Mm-hmm. Just as Peter Coe was let go and Arthur Penn came in, Arthur Penn said, you know, I think part of the trouble is that our playwright has sadly died in the midst of rehearsals. He said, you know, alas, we have no Odette. We need an equivalently powerful writer. Mm-hmm. And I should bring on board my collaborator in the last few productions, William Gibson, which they did. William Gibson accepted the job, provided he could pay the producers $1 a day for the privilege of writing this color alert piece. The week before we came into Broadway, a week during which Sammy Davis was missing because, as it later turned out, he had been invited to perform at a mafia wedding.
Oh, you don't say no to that.
No. And even his wife didn't know where he was. It was a very touchy time.
Oh, jeez.
And during that time, William Gibson, thank you, said, you know, Sammy should have Joey is the character, should have a song from the grave after he dies in the car crash. And he said, I think, you know, it's such an important kind of plot moment that I think I should write the lyric. Shook Strauss and Adams a bit, but he did. He wrote the lyric. I heard it once. It will never leave me. It was performed for the first preview on Broadway.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm standing in the wings with Jimmy Brennan and Bi Oakley, who I'm sure you know.
Of course, yeah.
And she was standing sort of up to Jimmy's knees in the wings by the prompt desk as Sammy's disembodied voice from the grave sang out, and the whole cast is now like Our Town with umbrellas filling the stage, you know?
Yes, yes, the gold graveyard scene.
Yes. And he sings, take my skin, Lord, now that I'm dead, and wash it in the river of tears I've shed. Hang it out to dry, Lord, on a line of gold. I ain't cold. And Bayek looks up to Jimmy and says, oh, doesn't that make you want to cry? And he says, sure does, honey. I was sure we had 2 years out of this sucker. Now we'll be lucky to get 2 weeks.
Oh, my God, that's good.
Stagehands always
lyrics.
Know. Yeah.
Those lyrics. Yeah. Wow, I'm glad we have that on record forever.
How did you get from England to New York?
Well, my girlfriend came over here to do The Boyfriend. And during the time that she was in rehearsal, sorry, also during the time she was performing in The Boyfriend, we had been communicating. And
so you were in London she was in New York and you could communicate?
Yeah. I was still working as a stagehand, and actually I had just started to work as a designer. Mm. Because the scenic artist there had asked if I would help him painting the sets and so on. And after a bit, he said, you know, our next production in 2 weeks' time is going to have 23 sets. It's an underwater pantomime. He said, would you co-design it? And so I did, you know. Anyway, so that, I was doing that, and I was also, this is a whole other story, but a student at a wonderful art college in London, associated with the London College, called the Slade School of Fine Art.
Wow.
And so I was doing that simultaneously with stagehanding and scenic arting at Wimbledon Rep.
You know, I wanted to ask you about, you worked with George Abbott.
Yes.
What was it like working with Mr. Abbott?
Oh, golly. I was just saying to Amanda before you came in, I said, if they don't have an interesting question, I think I'm going to say, ask me what was it like to work with George Abbott.
We still owe Amanda $20 for tipping us.
Exactly, yeah.
At any rate, it was extraordinary because, of course, at the time, he was probably not even as old as I am now, but I thought this is clearly the oldest person I'm ever going to work with in my life.
We've heard this from so many people we've interviewed in all decades that when they meet George Abbott, they think he's the oldest man ever.
Yes. And of course, we met him again not long before he died at the opening night of Damn Yankees, the Jack O'Brien production.
Yes.
Victor Garber and
B.B. Newworth.
B.B., my beloved B.B. And you probably know the story. He was trapped on the opening night because they wanted him to be in evidence. And as you know, the Marriott Marquis has no center aisle.
Right.
It's continental seating, you know. And they had walked him across to the center. So in the intermission, he was trapped and he had left his walker at the back of the auditorium.
Oh.
And so he was fair game to journalists and TV interviewers and so on. One of the sort of hot shit interviewers, I think for a TV channel, said, Mr. Abbott, I was just reading your bio in Playbill, for which, of course, he'd been originally the producer, director, book writer. And he said, I'm just flabbergasted at your range of experience over the years you've been in this business. Is it possible to say what's been the most extraordinary change in the theater during your time in it? And he went, electricity, I think. And of course, he wasn't joking.
No.
Let me just
absolutely
give you one more George Abbott
please,
thing.
He was please,
because that
as
was an
much
extraordinary
as you want to give us.
I was originally working with Jerry Robbins, who had been the original director of the musical of Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, and had worked closely during the previous year with Sondheim and Bert Shevelov and Larry Gelbart.
Yeah.
And he had had a huge success with his ballet company, Ballet USA, at the Spoleto Festival, the real Italian Spoleto Festival. And it had gone so well that he had been invited to undertake a world tour with his ballet company. So he excused himself from Forum. If you choose to know the real reason, as seen by Larry Gelbart,
yes,
he has an autobiography called Laughing Matters, or Laughing Matters. and he tells the true, somewhat blacker story of what went on. So by the time he was invited back in, because when the show opened in New Haven, it was in a lot of trouble, and I remember being in my little New Haven hotel room the morning after the opening night and listening, having my little room service breakfast and hearing George Abbott being interviewed on the radio and saying, you know, I'm pretty sure we could save this sucker if we could throw out all the songs. Now, of course, it was Steve Sondheim's first show for which he'd done both words and
music. Exactly.
And so he went to Hal immediately and said, we've got to get Robbins back.
Yeah.
Hal said, of course, we're going to have to get by Zero amongst many of the others, you know, to get this accepted. And Steve said, I know you can do it now. So Hal did talk to Zero, and Zero said, what are you saying now? We have to work with him? Does that mean we have to eat with him? And Hal said, no, as you know, he's the greatest show doctor there is for a situation like we're in now. And of course you don't have to eat with him, you know. But you can put your trust in him and know that if there's anybody who can pull us out of this mess,
right,
he'll be the one to do it. So Robbins came in. We're all lined up in the National Theater on the stage in Washington. And Robbins was dangerously with his back to the orchestra pit on account of other stories you know well.
It's all in my eyes.
was introducing himself to all of us. And he was socially an adorable guy,
okay,
as crazy and difficult and nuts, mm-hmm, as he was to work with. So he was deliciously saying hello and introducing himself to all of us one by one. And each one of us in their turn assumed for sure that we were the one that was about to be thrown out and replaced. You know?
Yeah.
So the tremendous tension in the air,
boy,
which rose and rose as he got closer to zero. Because, of course, there wasn't anybody there who didn't know that zero had lost about 10 years of work,
right,
on account
because
of being named,
yeah,
by... Robbins finally got to zero. Zero took a little step backward and said, "Hiya, loose lips." And everybody just burst out laughing, including Robbins, because so that pricked the balloon. And from then on, they sort of got along.
They did. They get along.
Yeah.
So I was curious, how did your involvement with Bob Fosse come to be?
Well, we were sort of friendly, Gwen and he and Julie and I. There was a bit of an overlap between people's perception of the All-American Gwen and Julie, the girl next door, as it were, you know. and they did some double acts on the Gary Moore show and Sullivan show and things like that, Julie and Gwen. One wonderful, I remember, dance that they did together and song was in Wellington boots, gum boots, with umbrellas, "Wait Till the Sun Shines, Nelly." And it was a sort of a tap dance in these rubber boots.
And so that's how you got into Bob Fosse's
world. Well, I think that Stuart Ostro originally approached Boris Aronson about Pippin. And I was sort of a protege of Boris Aronson's. I kind of worshipped him. And I was actually a huge believer in his belief that you have to abandon everything you know and restart as a baby with each project. And in that way, discover what is the special nature of this new thing you're approaching, you know, and whether it stems from the music or the lyricist, or who is the sort of prime force or the central energy behind it.
What a role model, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Those are special.
How did you even come up with the design for Pippin?
Bob was an extraordinary collaborator because he didn't come in with any fixed ideas at all. Which is sometimes very tricky if you're a designer. But his nature as a director was so sort of encouraging of your finding your own responses. So there was a time when we were about to have the first major meeting with him, once Pat Zebrod and I had something ready to show him. And I had, in the meantime, been working on the poster. And he was the first theater person of any sort to think it'd be interesting to have the designer of the show design the poster. And so he asked me to do it. He said, "It always disappoints me or confuses me whenever I go and see a show and none of the expectations that I've had from looking at the poster are followed through by what I then get to see." So I did that, you possibly remember,
mm-hmm,
the poster of the figures.
Yeah.
That, And I found while I was doing it and checking on in with him on it from time to time that his sort of attention to detail was absolutely immaculate, stunning. I'd never come across anything like it. I mean, he said, I understand the shoelaces on those shoes. Why did you choose red? And it was a question for everything. Anyway, so we've come to... He had included Pat in that mention that he thought the palette, the color palette, should be sort of rural, should be earth colors and olives and drabs and so on, you know. And she had gone off to a house that she had or was renting in Martha's Vineyard. Thank you, Tanya. And she phoned up from there just before leaving to come back in a great state of distress and saying, Tanya, I don't know what I'm going to do. I've had an appalling plumbing crisis at my house here, as a result of which I haven't been able to finish the sketches. They're all drawn up, and I got so far as to put in the flesh colors and occasionally some small accent that takes advantage of a flesh color or a pink or whatever, but otherwise they're still just white paper. And I said, well, you know, bring them anyway and let's just brazen it out. And so she came and I said, you know, it's fabulous to look at these because I just did an opera in London, The Love for Three Oranges, in which I had all the characters, with the exception of the principals, the goodies and baddies, as it were, all in white or shades of white, and the goodies and baddies either in an innocent pale blue or a purple or whatever. And to my astonishment, because everybody said when they saw the sketches, this is just going to be too self-conscious to be possible to follow the storyline.
Right.
But it wasn't, and it really worked well. So I mentioned this, and I showed her some photos of it and so on. I said, so why don't you leave them how they are? They look, you've done the faces, you've done they look sort of complete if the costumes were white. And so she said to him, Bob, I hope you won't be offended, but somehow I was never able to take on board the drab rural palette
right.
that you mentioned. As much as anything, because I can't picture a Bob Fosse production in those colorings, you know. And of course, he sort of loved that.
Yeah, of course.
And he went for it.
Hey, podcast listeners! Are you looking for a place to rehearse in New York City that is clean, spacious, and most importantly, affordable? Come check out Shetler Studios and Theaters, our wonderful host for these podcasts. Shetler is centrally located on West 54th Street between Broadway and 8th Avenue, right in the heart of the theater district.
Right in the heart, you'll find music, dance, and acting studios, complemented by two black box theaters and six presentation venues. The professional facilities, inspired environment, and expert industry staff combined to provide the New York artist with an unparalleled studio experience.
Visit their website at ShetlerStudios.com. That's S-H-E-T-L-E-R Studios.com.
Shetler Studios and Theaters is our home for recording the legends of Broadway, and we hope that you make it your artistic home too.
That's Shetler, S-H-E-T-L-E-R Studios.com. See you here.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that With brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
I'm sure all productions are challenging in some way, shape, or form. What has been the most challenging one for you in terms of getting a project and going, I have no idea what to do with this?
Well, I think I would have to say, alas, that it would have to be 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, yeah.
Oh, I'm happy you brought it up, because we didn't know if we were going to bring it up.
Funny you should say that. I think this is one of the first times we've talked about 1600 Pennsylvania on our show.
I think so. So tell us, Tony, please.
Well, what was that experience like? This is the piece by Leonard Bernstein, just that the listeners might not, I mean, most of our listeners know this, but yeah.
Yes, Leonard Bernstein and Alan Lerner.
Yes.
The two Leonard major Bernstein. Creatures in the musical theater at the time. Frank Cossaro, rather surprising choice of director, but presumably driven by Bernstein on account of his being essentially an opera director.
Exactly.
And I found it very hard to demonstrate effectively without repeatedly destroying the model, to demonstrate to Frank how all of these old bits of scenery from other shows that were bundled around on stage could be progressively whitewashed by the actors in their half rehearsal, half character clothing, so that by the time they pushed them all together at the end, they became an acceptable image of the White House. And, in order to prove it, I had to wreck my little model pieces from the way they looked when they were supposed to be pieces from the old mill or some ancient production. So that was tricky, but it became difficult because I was costume designer as well as scenic designer, and we were loading the show in Philadelphia, and it was this funky old backstage theater thing with bits and pieces from shows of the past, gradually and magically coming together to be appropriate. Alan Lerner phoned the morning, no, I guess it was the night of the Gypsy run-through, which, as you well know, is always the best the show ever is.
Yeah, best audience, too.
yeah. And the audience is always imagining their ideal version because they don't see any real sets or real costumes or anything, so it's whatever for them would be the perfect way to set or costume it.
Yeah.
And Alan was on the phone. I was down on the phone in the basement. And he said, Tony, as you know, we had the Gypsy run through last night. And I said, yes. Was it thrilling, Alan? And he said, well, I wouldn't quite use that word to describe it. It was more perhaps calamitous than thrilling. Nobody got what we were trying to do.
They
sat there with their jaws hanging open. And also, they didn't get the premise. And you have to have everything changed into the realistic version of wherever we're supposed to be at any given moment. I said, well, I mean, I'll do my best. God only knows what I can come up with in that time. But do we have enough of a budget left to make a change of this sort? He said, well, that's the other problem. The money all came from my Harvard roommate, who's now the head of Coca-Cola. And when he discovered the subject, the nature of the subject, the story we're telling, he took all their money out. And as I go, four or five bulky Coca-Cola employees are removing the Coca-Cola machine from the basement. Oh, it's a vicious, an astonishing image of efficiency on the part of an organization.
Pull that plug fast.
That's intense. Yeah. That's very intense.
So it was tricky. Now, simultaneously, I had developed one of the first cases of Legionnaire's disease.
Oh.
Which stemmed from the hotel in Philadelphia where we were staying. And because nobody knew what it was, it hadn't at that time been identified. So it was like I had a triple flu. And from time to time, I was completely nuts. And eventually, it came to the time when, understandably, director-choreographer Gilbert Moses and George Faison, it was, and it was clear to them that some mischief was afoot. They hadn't yet seen any of the things that they'd requested. And so I went to Bob White and said, Bob, one of us has to tell them. If you can't, I have to. And he said, you can't. He said, we have this huge company. And whichever of us tells them is going to be responsible for putting this entire company out of work. And I said, well, I don't know how to maintain the illusion any longer. So if you can't, I have to say something. And he said, well, I beg you not to, and I won't myself, and we'll find another way. And I said, then please forgive me, but I need to resign from the production. And he said, it's the only time I've ever done. And he said, please don't do that. It'll look like the last of the rats leaving a sinking ship.
Well,
I said, So I did leave, and I wasn't in good shape at all.
Yeah,
I was simultaneously designing the streamers that David Ray played for Mike Nichols. And at one point I had to phone up, and with a voice even worse than this one, say, Mike, I can't get down to, I'm trying to remember where we started out, Long Wharf. It'll probably be another couple of days before I can attempt to get out of bed. And he said, oh, my poor love, I sympathize so much. I have walking pneumonia myself.
Touché. Oh.
So, yes, so, of course, I had to get up and go, and we plugged on through with that.
You were two peas in a pod.
Another brilliant artist I wanted to ask you about is that the Guys and Dolls revival is so iconic. The set design is so brilliant. And the harmony that you and William Ivy Long created together on stage. How did you come to that? That must have been a challenge if one of you was off.
It was both a challenge for both of us. But it was a challenge for me partly because for designers in general, but particularly New York-y Broadway type designers, Joe Melzina was, you know, God Almighty.
Yeah.
And I had seen Guys and Dolls in London in, probably the late 40s with Julie, one of the few dates where I was allowed to take her to London on a date without a mother or a chaperone or so on. And it was the same sort of wild success in London as it was here. And there were many of the same cast members.
Yeah.
At least three of the principals were the same. And so my memory of it was daunting. And my appreciation of Melzina's work was such that I was really anxious about how to deal with the extent to which I couldn't help but be influenced by him. And then I thought, well, it was odd. His palette, color palette for it was clearly a way of stopping it fully becoming a fairy story, because famously Damon Runyon had said, it isn't 42nd Street, it's Runyon Land. And so Jerry Zatz took that on board as well. And I think we were also helped by Cy Feuer, because he had, of course, been to see and probably was marginally involved in the National Theatre's Guys and Dolls, mm-hmm. which was pretty much realistic because they had actors.
Right.
Who were lucky if they sang or danced at all.
Yes.
And which, of course, the British love.
Of course.
They love that. You know, oh, look, he's almost dancing. Oh, huh? Almost. She's almost singing.
True.
And anyway, I called up Cy Pure and had said, how did that work, the realistic thing? And he said, well, for me, not at all. I mean, it's a show that their version was on a revolve and kept moving all the time, you know. But for me, it's a show that takes place in one and in full stage alternately. Mm. It's, in terms of book scenes, there's almost never more than two or three people on stage, and then there's a big full company scene, a number. So everything has to be changed behind the in one drop in order to get to the big company number. And he said, I once staged it myself in Los Angeles. Do you remember who that was, the producer in Los Angeles?
Edwin Lester.
Edwin Lester.
Edwin yeah, Lester. Well yeah. done.
Oh, teamwork.
My God. Just
hey, you're a good company yeah. here, my friend.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He said, I think I did this for Ed Lester. And I tried because I'd been conscious of how simplistic Joe's original design scheme yeah. was to make it, to adjust it a bit. So there were different choices scenically with most of the scenes. And I can't pretend it worked. And I asked Abe Burrows, who came to see it, what he thought was wrong with it. And he said, you changed the scenic structure of it. I said, it's a little machine that never goes wrong, provided you embrace it with the way it's constructed,
right.
which is intimate scenes, full scenes, intimate scenes. And Jerry Zaks, of course, is incredibly alert to mechanics of that sort. And so he was, when I mentioned what Cy had said, he was very taken with that and said, well, we better stick with that. And he said, anyway, one of the reasons I'm doing this is because of my long love affair with the theater that came about, I think he said, as a result of seeing Wonderful Town on Broadway as the show with painted drops and scrims and so forth in the old style. And that's when I fell in love with musical theater. And it seemed the best way to play it. And sometimes when I see something now and it uses projection or whatever, I'm in some way disappointed that it's not embraced as fully by its sort of technical and visual surroundings as perhaps it should be. So, and he said, and anyway, I love your illustration stuff. So why don't you sort of illustrate the show rather than designing it? So that's how that look came about.
Because our time is almost up with you, I have one last question for you, which is, what advice would you give to an aspiring designer that's now starting to come up the ranks? Maybe somebody who's in a grad school program or an undergraduate program who hasn't come to New York yet. What's the best piece of advice you think you can leave them with?
I think in a way, it's almost a sort of negativity, is see what no's you can find. Like starting out listening to the music or absorbing it in whatever way you can. Say to yourself, this is not green or whatever. This is not prickly. This is somehow soft, you know. Try to find the things it isn't and whittle that down to what's left. But of course, people learning these days have such an amazing alphabet of technical gizmos to draw from.
Yeah.
And I think that in many ways that's a shame, that often when you see a fully projected show, but even the Des Makhanov revival of Guys and Dolls, you know, which was substantially projected, you spend too much time thinking what just happened, mm-hmm. and because of watching what you're watching,
right.
missing mm-hmm. some crucial dialogue yeah. or whatever. So I once heard, forgive me for dropping a thundering great big name, but I once heard Fellini say in an interview, I try very hard to make myself available, to not fix my ideas, so that whatever comes up in the moment, or whatever mysterious image I suddenly see, can take power.
Tony, this has been such an absolute pleasure. I feel like we just scratched the surface.
I know.
There's so much. There's so much more to do. Maybe one day you'll join us for a part two if you're so inclined.
Should I not topple off my twig?
No. Yes, we would be an honor.
This has been so much fun.
Truly a pleasure.
So much fun to me.
Sure. Well, it truly is a pleasure to go there with you.
Yes.
And thank you for taking
blessed.
There. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Till next time, everyone. Take care.
Today's episode was recorded at Shetler Studios on 244 West 54th Street. Visit Shetler Studios to book your room today, and you could be as cool as us. That's Shetler Studios.com.
And a big thanks to our sound editor, Daniel Schwartzberg, and social media manager, Bethany Ann Selecki.
And friends, don't forget, we want more folks to hear these incredible stories, and that's where you guys can come in and help us out.
Yes, in order for people to find out about us, we need lots of ratings on iTunes. The more ratings, the more they'll come up in searches. So head on over to iTunes, search for Behind the Curtain Broadway's Living Legends, click on our logo, click on ratings and reviews, then write a review and leave us 5 stars and make us feel as special as Eliza Doolittle on Eliza Doolittle Day.
Or you can leave us 1 star and make us feel as bad as Annie did in that weird production in Boston where Annie dreamed about being adopted and then ended the show back in the orphanage. True story, Rob was there.
I saw it. So head on over to iTunes and make us feel even more special than we already do.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.